I guess we have to finish up this morning, don't we? Yesterday we were, I know we'd like, we could continue that conversation about differences between men and women and things about, you know, gender and loaded words and so forth. We could do a whole week on that. But there is something that I want to move on to. We were talking yesterday about language as a reflection of your identity and how, at a personal level, it can reflect attitudes and intentions, and at a social level, it kind of puts you where you belong in the group that you belong to. And of course, you belong to many different groups, so that sometimes you have many different ways of speaking depending on which group you're being a part of at the time. And then there is the much broader question of the cultural identity, that is, what group in, let's say, in out there in the world you belong to. And this is a little bit difficult for us as speakers of English to grasp, because English is so widespread, it belongs to so many different groups. It doesn't identify us as belonging to a single culture, because English is just spread everywhere and there are many different cultures of English speakers. I suppose now we think in smaller terms, like there are folks who speak Minnesotan, you know, a sub-variety of English.
I think I've been influenced by their Scandinavian background. That's what they pick up.
Well, some people claim it's also, you know, it's a combination of many kinds of cultural things, including religion. There's a, you know, a hint of Lutheran in it, and so forth. But there are many places in the world where a particular language is associated very crucially with an identifiable culture. And if you look at places like well, I'm thinking more in terms of Africa, where you have a tribal society, and each tribe has their own customs, their own stories, and the language to go with it. So there's more of a one-to-one correspondence between a language and some distinct culture. If we go back to the way things probably were a long time ago, say at least more than 10 or 15,000 years ago, we did not have the phenomenon of widespread languages. That area that I was talking about on the island of New Guinea, on that island alone, there are over 1,000 distinct languages. Some of them have no more than 100 or 200 speakers. I think the smallest one is somewhere in the highlands in Papua New Guinea, and it's recorded as having about 25 speakers in one village. In the village I visited that I described yesterday, there were 110 people in approximately 10 extended families. And that's more than half of the speakers of that entire language in one village. And these aren't just like the difference between Georgia and Texas. You know, that if you, with a lot of goodwill, you can understand each other, that sort of thing. But the folks further up the river can't even begin to understand the language in that village. These are really distinct languages. Anyway, there is speculation, at least. We can't tell for sure, of course. One of the things about language is you can't do archaeology on it very well. If it's not written, it ain't there. Quite possibly, this is more like the way the world was before the invention of things like agriculture. where there were many, many distinct languages. In fact, there's a guess that we count today approximately estimates vary, 4 to 6,000 different languages in the world. Think for a minute, 1,000 of those are on one island. We figure that maybe in the period of, say, 5,000 BC, or perhaps a little earlier, between 8 and 5,000 BC, somewhere in there, there may have been as many as 10,000 different languages. And in those cases, we find that whether it's a tribal organization, or whether there are kingdoms, or whether whatever the kind of political organization, and in fact, the folks I was talking about yesterday, they don't appear to have any political organization. If you walked into the village and asked who's in charge, they wouldn't know. They organized in clans, right? It's extended family and so forth. And they can have feuds and wars between clans. Just because you don't have politics doesn't mean you don't have wars. But, so quite possibly, in the very early days of civilization, that's the way things were. They didn't practice agriculture. They lived off the land. And a very strong index of the sort of cultural identity was what language you spoke. So your belonging was defined through your language and who your relatives were, basically. Didn't have flags and armies and, you know, all the trappings of nations and so forth. So it was quite a different landscape back then, and all of our indications are that these very small languages disappear rapidly. In fact, the situation right now, if we look at the present situation, there's a linguist in Alaska, Michael Krause, at the Center for North American Languages there, who estimates that North American native languages are becoming extinct faster than animals, plants, and birds. The problem is simple. Most of them are oral languages, and the only people speaking them today are the older generation. When they die, so will the language. Krause estimates that close to 200 native North American languages, of those nearly 150 are no longer being spoken by children. And this isn't only a North American phenomenon. Krauss and others estimate that almost half of the world's 6,000 languages, so this book takes the larger end of the scale, will be gone in the next 100 years, and nearly half of the 3,000 that will be left will eventually go too. They think we will finally be reduced to about 5% of the world's languages that exist today, maybe 300 in all, or perhaps only 200. English is surely to be one of those. But it's kind of like the industrialization of language, you know, that the interesting thing is that if we look at the history of language, and this is something we haven't spoken about, the dimension of history, and how from a very simple hunter-gatherer society around the world, there arose some technology, basically. Technology has been behind most of this. Two significant areas where technologies had impact on the spread of languages, where one language will be removed from its little stretch of river and spread all around. And one of them is agriculture. The other one is warfare. That is, the idea of larger and larger kingdoms, where one group will take over another. But probably the thing responsible for the spread of the European languages is the innovation of agriculture. We have a fairly good idea now how that happened. And if you look at the European language family, we have, for the past 100 years, a lot of linguists, mostly in Europe and a lot in other places around the world, have been working on reconstructing the ancestral European language. It's now believed to have originated somewhere in Turkey and migrated slowly, very slowly, following lines of early agriculture. And the way early agriculture worked was you didn't buy a farm and then live on it and have it handed down to your children. Basically, you moved by generations. They didn't have fertilizers and so forth, so you worked the soil and it was played out, and then you got a new piece of ground. And some of the original Indo-Europeans, as they're called, went in the northwest direction and ended up ultimately in Scandinavia, England, and places like that. Others moved eastward and ended up on the Indian subcontinent. And so the descendants of this language family are located from India all through Europe. And along the way, it began to differentiate and divide into larger language families, like there is the branch that became Latin, and then eventually the other Romance languages, Spanish, French, and so forth, Italian. Then there was that barbaric branch that went way up north into Scandinavia and founded the Germanic branch of the family. And spread out from Scandinavia over the northern part of Europe and England. There's the Slavic branch that went up to the northeast, and so you can see how they scattered from this core, probably in Turkey somewhere, in practically all directions. There are even little remnants of the Indo-European languages in Central Asia, in the middle of Russia. Fortunately, they developed a technology that's traceable. One of the early styles of writing was scratching on clay tablets so that you can actually decipher these things and figure out who was there and what sort of language they spoke. So this kind of dispersal of a language appears to be a model that was typical in the ancient world, and it marks this technological transition from bows and arrows and eating what you could catch to settling down, domesticating animals, and growing your own food. And that marks an enormous watershed. About the same time, an entirely different group was migrating, and that was a little earlier than this, because we have varying estimates that from the period of about 10 to 8,000 BC to perhaps 20 or 30,000 years earlier, there was still a land bridge between Siberia and Asia. And people moved across that bridge from Asia and began to populate North America. North America was empty of people before then. The archaeologists are still arguing over how old particular chunks of stone axe are, things like that. But the estimates range from anywhere from about 11,000 years ago up to maybe 50 or at least 35,000 years ago. People began moving into North America. It's very interesting linguistically. There ended up being about 1,000 different languages in North and South America. All of them came across this bridge, or they descended from languages that did. And the interesting thing is that studies are going on, there's a great controversy going on over just how many different groups came across the bridge and so forth. One theory that's hotly debated right now is that really there are only three groups. There's a big group from which most of the North and South American, what we would call Indian languages, descended. The generic name given to is Amerind. Now, Amerind is an anthropological term that applies to people who live in the Americas but are not Eskimos or Aleuts. That is, that racially and ethnically they're quite distinct. But there is one small group of perhaps 30 to 40 languages called Nadeni, which don't belong to this group. They are fairly significant because they are among the largest groups still speaking a language in North America, and that includes the Navajo. They are located in the southeastern U.S. and another big bunch up in Canada around the Great Slave Lake. So those groups, although it's a very small number of languages, are fairly significant in North America. So Eskimo Aleut is one group, and they are distributed around the northern part of the world. You find them in Greenland and northern Siberia and in northern North America. The Amerinds, they're all the rest except for these Na'adenes, the Navajos and their relatives, and the ones up in Canada. So it's an interesting distribution. It's not uncontroversial, but that leaves about 960 different languages spread across North and South America that are thought to have perhaps descended from the same basic language, or perhaps a few related ones that came across in that first migration. So here's another factor that had to do with the distribution of languages. It's migration. Now, migration that's related to agriculture went one way. It was very slow. It went very tediously based on largely on the agricultural technology, which said after a generation or so you needed new land. So they'd move a few miles down the road. So this went on for, thousands of years, very slowly. Another one is the kind of mass migration where people decide, well, let's pick up and go somewhere else. And they just start moving, and they move through country until they find something they like. They may stay there a few more years and migrate onwards. It's almost that nomadic life, but as time went on, they began to be more settled, and they would build more permanent settlements and stay in a particular area. And that's how we ended up basically with the ethnographic landscape, that is the distribution of native people in North America that we have. One group, the Salish group, gravitated towards the Northwest here. So the Salish and their relatives are all located up here. But we can compare all of their languages and examine the similarities and, in a sense, reconstruct an earlier form of Salish, which was probably the one language that from the ancestral group that was spoken that came to this region. So it's a successive series of dispersal and differentiation. So each group that sort of goes off on its own develops their own variety of, in this case, a Salish. And they're related, yet they're quite distinct and different. So what happened then in the last anywhere from 10 to 30,000 years, both over in Europe or in North America, was a new sort of order where languages began to move around and be found dispersed all over the place. And if you look at the history of the modern world, that as we get into even more technology, it's happening at an even more rapid pace, and languages like Spanish and English are just flooding all over vast areas of territory. Why is that? Why does English spread like it does, almost like wildfire?
Because of technology, people need to be able to talk to each other.
Okay, there's a need for a standard for communication where people can talk to each other. It's just like the story of the Scandinavian countries after World War II when they started those pan-Scandinavian business enterprises like SAS. They had to have something they could talk among themselves.
World War II accelerated everything.
That's right.
The British Empire.
The British Empire had something to do with it, yes. There's an example where political power combined with military power had an influence on what languages were imported to particular areas. It didn't always work that way. The Dutch, for example, in their colonies tended to use, appropriate and use some local language. In the in Southeast Asia, for example, they are responsible not for the spread of Dutch down there, which didn't spread very well at all, but for the spread of Malay. There are many different countries now which use varieties of Malay, which were introduced by the Dutch. They decided that would be their standard for local governments, and consequently, Indonesian is really a variety of Malay that is was used in the original Dutch colony. So the bosses, as it were, can decide what language is used. The English tended to say, we'll use English. Hence, English is a native language of people in India. And that very accented speech that we hear, that we associate with an East Indian accent, is really a native English accent. It's a variety of English. Yes?
Do you feel that the areas like the Dutch occupied that have been allowed to keep their own identity through their language have been more stable politically than areas where they had to negotiate?
Well, in fact, they didn't get to keep their own language. Malay wasn't necessarily the local language. It became the government language. Indonesia is one of those countries that has there are probably within its boundaries there are 800 or 900 different languages. Yes, and from very diverse ethnically there are, in terms of if you look at the sort of racial stock of Indonesia that ranges from Melanesian in the east to clearly Southeast Asian Orientals in the west, and that there are all different varieties within this one country.
Tom, a question about Malay or Indonesia. The Muslim religion is so predominant there, we found.
Mm-hmm.
Do they universally follow one language and then they expect their congregations or groups to follow? What are they called?
Well, groupings? The so-called holy languages occupy a bit of a different status. One of the very early Indo-European languages, Sanskrit, was a holy language, but many times it's kept almost like a secret, that it's for the priestly class, and other people shouldn't really speak the holy language. Now, Arabic, of course, is critically important to the Muslim religion, and it is taught in Muslim schools. But there's no indication that it ever makes much of a dent in the local commercial language or something like that. It is seen as having religious significance, and it's important for your religion to be able to read the Quran in Arabic and so forth. It's interesting, in fact, studies have been done that in Muslim countries where people will list Arabic as one of the languages they use, yet on the street there's almost no trace of it. And they will, some people even claim to be primarily Arabic speakers, and the reason is religious, you know, that, well, I better claim to be an Arabic speaker because that's, you know, my religious language. The fact that I go to the market and buy my food and something else is irrelevant. So languages occupy different niches as far as their function goes.
That's true of Latin.
Yes. Yes, I have a colleague who's Greek Orthodox, and he said, well, the Pope spoke Latin and Luther spoke German, but God speaks Greek.
Probably spoke Jewish or Aramaic.
Aramaic is what he spoke, yeah. So, you know, we have different attachments to different languages. We, today, though, as speakers of English, when you consider that we... How is it that the information about our culture is transmitted to us? You know, we go to school. How do we get information about the society, the culture we live in? Yes, but in what form?
Books.
Aha, books. Right, we go to school, we read books. We go to the bookstore and we buy stuff and we find out what's going on, you know. We sort of get into, the, you know, remember when there were all the bestsellers about angels? You know, angels were terrific. I don't know if they're still on the list or not, but they're terrifically interesting and, you know, well, that's a cultural trend, you know. That's, we go through these fads and fashions where people are interested in things. We find that out by reading, you know. We read the newspaper, magazines, books, and so forth. When you think, though, that 5,000-10,000 years ago, scarcely anyone had access to these things. Even 500 years ago, when the printing press was something new, there was no technology for widespread access to writing. In the ancient Indic religions, where Sanskrit was the treasured language, monks actually memorized the grammar of the language. Can you imagine that for a job? Mm-hmm. Let's see, today I'm going to memorize relative clauses. So they could teach the next generation of monks about this holy language, because people didn't grow up learning it as children, right? You had to be inducted into the priestly class before you could learn it. And they generally didn't in the beginning do it with books. Eventually it was all written down, but we have a great advantage in having writing and printing presses and now computers to store all this stuff. Now, how many of you know your genealogies? How did you find out about them?
The Mormon library.
My father, in my father's case, although he was born in the States, he did pay an archivist in Germany to do a lot of research. But then he had it translated, all which he was capable of doing. But we traced our family back. Well, not in the time of his view, it wouldn't be considered much, but back to like the 1520s.
Yeah. But that was by looking at old records, wasn't it? Anybody get their genealogy because your grandmother or someone just recited it all to you?
That's what I got.
Yeah.
My mother, at the age of 75, wrote histories on both sides of her family. Mm-hmm.
One thing that we've enjoyed, my wife's parents have every Christmas written down a 2 or 3 page story, a family story, and given it to the kids so that they have this collection of little folders full of these stories. And nowadays, that's the way we think of preserving something. Well, quick, write it down before somebody forgets it, you know. But you consider in a culture that had no writing, your genealogy, your family, who you belong to, had to be told to you. Not only that, you had to remember it all. You can think that people had well-developed memories. You also had those sort of cultural things like, well, you know, war stories, stories of great achievements of people. All that was memory work. A lot of the work we do in looking at the native languages in this area is getting people to tell their stories. And I've run into old gentlemen who themselves were not warriors, but they knew stories their fathers or grandfathers had told them, which were war stories. It was great entertainment for them to tell them, you know, to relive the old days that they never took part in, but... Yeah.
Another good example in recent years is Roots.
Yes.
The verbal history of the Africans over generation for generation into our country, right up to the present day, which resulted in a best-selling novel and excellent movie and so forth. Mm-hmm. Amazing verbal history.
But here's the thing with this scenario here where languages disappear, you consider that all those stories disappear when the language does. And so one of the concerns of the elders in the native groups around here is that this will happen, and that the children and grandchildren will not know the stories, and they won't know where, you know, where they came from.
Tom, may I interrupt, please? Not necessarily. So that old original language fades out because the elders are dying. Mm-hmm. But they have told these stories to their the younger generations. There'll simply be some translations there. The younger generations have adapted a newer language, but like, although I said my father did this research in Germany, there were many, many oral stories told. Maybe that's what aroused one's curiosity.
The problem is that in languages that are not literate, that is, which has no writing system, a language that no one is used to writing, they also don't translate. And they don't, like, a grandparent will out and sit and tell the old story in English, even though they know English. The other problem is, particularly here in the Northwest, is that stories and dances and songs and so forth are cultural property. They're like heirlooms, and they belong to people. And so a grandparent may own particular stories and, in a sense, bequeath them to people. I've had the experience of listening to a story from a native woman whose grandfather had given her the story, and then she abruptly stopped. And I said, well, do you know how it ends? Yeah. Are you going to tell me? She said, no. She said, my grandfather hadn't given me part of it yet. It's not mine to tell. The same with dances. If a tribe gives a dance to another tribe, they've given it away. They never dance it again. It's not their property anymore. And they think in terms of property in much different, in a much different sense than we do. Now, nowadays in North America, there is a lot of consciousness of this, and people are working to, most North American languages have a writing system. It's fairly straightforward to develop it. You take the keys on the typewriter and you get a linguist to help sort out some of the sounds, and you can develop a way of writing. And people are writing these down. They're at least reaching what I call the first stage of conservation for a language, and that's the museum stage, where we have a dictionary, a description of the language, and some stories in books on the shelf. For many older generations, though, that doesn't satisfy them. They'd like to see it preserved as a living language where people speak it. And consequently, there is a lot of effort being put into bringing those languages into schools and actually teaching them to children again. It's sort of past the point with many of them where it's done at the home, because it's that middle generation who are in their 30s now who don't speak it anymore, so they can't teach the children. Invariably, at least in the Northwest, if we go into a village and look for the good speakers of a language, they're at least 80 now. It's really a problem finding someone who can remember some of the stuff we even know about from books that are 90 or 100 years old. There are various reasons for that. There are lots of, can you imagine why it is that local languages would die out in favor of something like English?
Very important to people who have built their land or want to move away to learn to use English, because that's the language of commerce.
Okay, well, there's the first reason right there. Money. Mm-hmm. Business.
Power. Political power. You didn't get very far.
Mm-hmm.
Giving your political speeches in our region.
That's right.
You want to run for governor.
Curiosity about all the people around you, and you mean our
intellectual curiosity, expanding your knowledge,
mm-hmm.
schooling.
Yes.
Learning English in school and being told that their language shouldn't be used, the native people.
Yes, we have to go back and we realize that educational policy in the last century, in the early part of this century, saw not only a sort of a cultural difference between, you know, the English-speaking culture and the local ones, but also a moral difference, that somehow it's more patriotic or more upright to speak English. And there was, in fact, you can read some of the utterances of the commissioners from the Bureau of Indian Affairs from the late 1900s that went on about, we do the natives no service by allowing them to continue speaking their barbaric tongues. And I have spoken to elders who can recall in school in the early days having their mouths taped shut for speaking their native language at school. So it was simply forbidden. And a program that we work in Kamloops, BC, our university has a joint program with the Shuswap people there, where we teach university courses. They also have a high school completion program for people who these are educational facilities run entirely by the natives. It's not part of the public school system. But it all takes place in the old residential school. And some of their elders can remember going to this school and not being allowed to speak their language. And they, with great relish, hold graduation ceremonies in there and point out the irony to it, because they always invite one of the provincial ministers of education or something to stick it in their face, you know, as it were.
Yeah. This center that I'm talking about at Nia Bay has quite a display and many, many pictures of that. Mm-hmm. You can see that they have pictures even of some of the kids with their mouths taped because I guess they said something to one of their roommates. Very strict. And the clothes, too, went into that. They had to wear the clothes that they were told to wear.
Mm-hmm. If you go to reservations now, you find a resurgence of interest in Native arts and culture, and they're investigating the kind of clothing that used to be worn, and they like to dress up in their ceremonial best and have dances and so forth. And it is this same phenomenon that you mentioned, the notion of roots getting back to origins. But there has been, in terms of language and in a lot of other cultural areas, a break where, because of this period where they had been told, your culture is not worthwhile. Put it aside and, you know, and take the many delights of the English culture, including the money and the fire water and everything else. And now they're scrambling to try to restore things. There is a sort of a second level of conservation for these languages, and that's what I call the kind of rescue, the rescue program, the program that is put into the schools to try to at least give the children some level of knowledge of the language as well as the culture. And one of the ways to do that is to convert the language from a strictly oral one to one that is literate. That is, so that there is actually a written form that they can use in the school, teach the children how to read in it. So if they want, later on, they can go back and look in those library shelves and see some of the old stories that people don't remember anymore. Yes?
I was on the Sky Train up in Vancouver recently.
Mm-hmm.
There were such a racial mix of people. It was incredible. But there were two Chinese speaking quite loudly in Chinese, and there was an older Caucasian or white man sitting beside them, and he said, "Speak English," and they did.
Amazing.
I've noticed there are all these languages going on around.
Yes.
And they do speak English. I'm sure. They don't speak English around well when they're in groups together.
Someone observed, minorities need to be bilingual. that applies to different racial groups, right? If you think of black urban English, a black person might speak one way in his home neighborhood, but if he's a bank teller at some downtown bank, switches into sort of normal everyday business English. But the same is true of minority populations in a place like Vancouver. They know English, but when they're among people who speak their language, they speak their language, and so they have two languages where many of us just use one normally.
But isn't part of it because they're just so much more comfortable speaking their own language? We have a large group of newer people in my church, and also a group of Laotians, and I work with the young high school age Laotians, and they're quite fluent in English. But when they're all together, the only language they speak is their own.
Well, those languages serve two different purposes for them. They're, in that case, the Laotian language serves as their language for cultural identity. They identify themselves. That is the reflection of them. And this is what the Native American groups are trying to achieve, where the language will be revived as a reflection of who you are and who you belong to, and the people will want to speak it again. And in many of the Oriental immigrant groups, like the Chinese in Vancouver, they are perfectly native. They have perfectly native ability. In fact, many of the younger ones have grown up speaking English, but they switch back and forth depending on cultural context. This is a fairly common situation around the world, where there is more than one language. And people switch back and forth depending. There may be one that's a business language, the one you would use to conduct business or go shopping or something like that, and another one you use at home or at church.
We lived in Belgium for a while. We were up in the Flemish part of the country. You know, that little country's divided right down the middle.
Yes.
French and the
South. Was not always a comfortable division either.
But we were in the Flemish part, and yet the engineers in the nuclear center all spoke French.
Yes.
All that business was in French, and yet if you got out of there, then you had to convert to either Flemish or English because they presented French outside of that compound.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Early in the missionaries went to the native villages in Alaska anyway.
Uh-huh.
And as they began to convert and teach the natives, they began to select the better children, you know, the brighter ones, and send them then back to a mission school somewhere.
That's right.
That was taught in English. And so that took the cream of the crop of these villages and put them back together in an English situation and in a European environment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which did a disservice in a sense, because when they went back, they were not the same cultures there.
That's right.
As their
and they missed a different education, because children were raised in a particular way in the tribe, and they were taught things. They had a traditional education system. And this brings me to another point, and that's, why should anyone care if some little group somewhere lets their language lapse? I mean, is it any skin off our nose? What goes away?
Well, I guess the same answer, the same question yesterday about this village that's undernourished.
Yeah.
They said thanks, but no thanks to the outside entity. If they want to stay within themselves, why should we bring in orange juice and the other things?
Mm-hmm.
To try to force a balanced diet on them. I mean, it's the same question.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, there is a question of information there. We find in these groups that, you know, they have very little knowledge of the outside world, but they are quick to recognize something that is useful to them. The missionaries in this area that I visited have brought in some medications. They have serious communicable problems, like there's an eye infection that goes around. Well, they know the missionary has eye drops. they know that's useful. You know, as soon as they have new information about something, they quickly can figure out what's good for them, and they want it. Now, I think in the long run, this the sort of thing that will permit them to make choices that will lead to their own decisions to improve things will be information, that is education. And what is going on in that area now is not so much here, this is all good for you, do this stuff. They're starting with pre-literacy classes, and they're trying to convert many of the local languages to literate languages where they can write, for example, little simple books about public health, a simple thing about what malaria is or how to wash your hands, things like that. Now, the other thing that we're finding out, though, and I have seen it many times where there are these interdisciplinary areas like medical anthropology or ethnobotany, that's the study of how native peoples use plants, that there is a great deal of intellectual wealth here, not only stories, but even technical knowledge, knowledge about the world. Things they know about plants in the jungle that we haven't even, I mean, plants we don't even have in our catalogs yet. Things they use. In Indonesia, there is also a segment that's not in the area I was talking about, but there's a segment that's in the South Seas sweet potato culture. Maybe you didn't know there are over 100 varieties of sweet potatoes, and they grow them all down there. They're not all yellow either. I've eaten white ones that look very much like regular potatoes, but they're distinctly sweet potatoes once you get into them. But that's part of their agriculture. They don't have fertilizers. They grow each year in each plot. They grow a different variety. They rotate their crops that way. They have different demands. But they take certain plants and grind them up into a paste and smear them on the stems of the sweet potatoes near the ground, and there are certain crawling insects and worms that won't crawl up the stems there. They have their own little insect control methods. And this information is all oral. I mean, it's passed on from father to son in this case when he's taught how to cultivate sweet potatoes. In some villages, you see this culture is so important. They have contests, an annual contest for the best sweet potato. They come in with these 20 and 30 pound sweet potatoes, and the guy who wins is considered the most eligible bachelor in the village and has his choice of brides, you know. Let's get married, my sweet potato. Why? Well, you won't go hungry with that guy. Look at the sweet potatoes he grows, right? Yeah.
My concept of the Jewish faith is that they have, and at least my Jewish friends, they have assimilated into the society, and they are, you know, the only way you know Jew from anybody else is if they told you, in a sense. But yet they keep their own traditions and their own language, and you know, they manage to do that.
Yeah.
Now, could that not? Is that not a reasonable guide for all these Indian groups to
yes.
They can pattern themselves after whatever it is that Jews do to do that?
Yes.
They seem to be doing it successfully.
I think for each local group, they have to decide what use is our culture to us, and what does the language serve to do? And they can decide that, and they can sort of divide up their lives accordingly. You know, this part is for the English general culture and the stuff that comes over the satellite dish, and then this is for our traditional culture, our sense of history, perhaps, something like that. Let me tell you about the Taos Pueblo. Have any of you ever visited there, Taos, New Mexico? In terms of preservation of an indigenous culture, they're perhaps among the most successful in North America, but they have the radical solution. Basically, it's a closed society. You can go there as a visitor from, say, 9 in the morning till 5 in the evening, and then you have to get out. there are anywhere from, I think they said, from 600 to 1,400 people living in the Pueblo, depending on the season. There's no running water, no electricity. The building itself is about 1,000 years old. It's, you know, it's those little adobe buildings stacked sort of on top of each other. I think it goes 3 or 4 story. They still practice their ancient religion. I was told that, you know, 95% of them are Roman Catholic as well. There's a Roman Catholic church on the edge of town. But they practice their ancient religion, and furthermore, they won't tell you anything about it. It's over a fence there. You see a few sticks sticking up, and they say, well, that's where we do our ceremonies, but we won't tell you any more than that. So by keeping entirely to themselves and keeping encapsulated, and there are members of the community who don't live there. They don't want to, in a sense, become monks of this culture. That they have been able to preserve it. And you walk the streets of this town and you hear children speaking the language and everything. It's still intact and they still keep it going. It's kind of like the Mecca of their particular culture. But that is not practical for most small native groups. It's just their choice. Many of the other groups will have a different choice. And some of them will just decide to disperse, and their language and their culture and their stories, their recollections, will disappear.
What's the name of this group?
Taos.
Taos?
T-A-O-S. There is a city, Taos, New Mexico, and the Taos Pueblo is just outside of town. You can buy lots of silver jewelry and stuff there, but at night it closes and everybody goes away. Everyone who's not a native goes away, yeah.
Is it the intent of the American and Canadian governments to assist these people or to set up procedures so they can maintain their languages?
Yes, it is now. In fact,
why would we, I'm just saying for argument, I guess, the Jews don't ask for any help. You know, they do their own thing. Why is it that we should subsidize.
Well, there is a feeling that policy of 100 years ago actually took things away from them, and now we should give it back.
Can we get free Norwegians?
Just let them
aim
over their mouth. Who did that to them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, in 1992, in 1992, Congress passed an act called the Native Languages Act. And it says that the native peoples have a right to preserve, protect, and promote the rights and freedom of Native Americans to use, practice, and develop native language or Native American languages. So this enables school districts and state governments and all kinds of programs to make special provision for native languages.
Of Indians, though, that's native. But
yes.
if our little group of Africans from Sudan,
mm-hmm.
they have to find their own way, although the schools
yeah.
are required to educate them. So that presents a whole new set of things.
Well, this brings us into the question of language policy, and this is a very interesting thing, because what's the official language of the United States? Do you know what it is? That's the answer. There isn't one. There is no official language.
Didn't they come close to voting?
Well, a lot of states have passed a law declaring English the official language. There are various motivations behind that. That's because it's cheaper if you don't have to print Spanish on the back side of every form or whatever. But there is a movement called the English Only Movement, which wants to make English the official national language. From my own experience, particularly in Canada, I would recommend that the U.S. avoid declaring anything the official language, because that's like drawing a line in the sand. And there's a very interesting situation. If In Canada, we have the instance of political issues getting wrapped up with what we call radical monolingualism, and that's, of course, Quebec. The present provincial government of Quebec, that is their policy. They passed a sign law a number of years ago outlawing any other language on public signs besides French. And this was enforced down to the letter of the law. There is a department store chain in Canada called Eaton's, apostrophe S. Well, in Quebec, they had to drop the apostrophe S off that because that was identifiably English. It's now just Eaton in Quebec. And there are old firms like Smith and Son, you know, a bookstore. And now it's just Smith because you can't have all that English stuff on the signs. Now you can have, it's interesting, you can't have that out on the front of the shop. It's public. But indoors in the shop, you can, and on your letterhead, you can call yourself Smith and Son. So that's an example of radical monolingualism. Well, there was a very strong movement in California a few years ago about making English radically monolingual, the language there. And a linguist got busy and figured out what this might lead to. And he came up with a year of something like 2005, where at present rates, the Hispanic population would be strong enough to change the official language of California and make it Spanish. I think he figured 2005 that at present rate, the segment of population growing the fastest in California is the Hispanic population. Their growth rate is considerably faster than anybody else.
San Diego, we have thousands come across every day who are illegal, and a lot of them never go back.
That's right, and eventually they become legal, is the point, and they stay in California.
California economy is suffering.
Well, in the school district where we are in Southern California, the Hispanic is over 50% now. So
yes.
No, it's happy bilingual too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And not only Spanish, but we've had a lot of the Asian.
Yes. Yes.
From another state that borders Mexico.
Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Even longer border.
Yeah, an even longer border.
That's right. That is shallow river.
The problem is we see it, or I'll speak for myself.
All right.
We look at Canada, and the French are going to speak French till hell freezes over. And there is a continuing problem. Texas consists, there are a bunch of Czechs, Germans, Swedes, everybody. They came into the United, not just Texas, but the United States, and we all got together, and we all decided on a common language. It just happens to be English. But we got together on a common language so we could get to, you know, and we could speak. There are so many ethnic groups here, and we all understand and love each other. But then hundreds of thousands of Spanish, another language, come and impose themselves on our society, and they're not willing to merge with everybody else so we can all speak the same language and all do the same thing together. And we look at Canada and see what happens from the English and the French, and it's not going to solve itself. So our interest is in not an attempt to have necessarily English as a common language, but to have a common language so that we can all merge these people in. And if they're here, then okay, let's get them into the pot and like everybody else, and let's all get together and do.
Well, don't want
to
learn Spanish.
Well, I think the idea behind having English as the primary language, something, you know, an attempt to try to assimilate these people if they're here, so that we don't have the same thing that you have in Canada.
Actually, what you're expressing is a kind of concern that was expressed in earlier waves of migration. The United States has experienced periods of migration where identifiable groups like bunches of Germans, bunches, you know, and And similar concerns were expressed then in the areas where they settled, because they tended, like they are now, they would settle approximately where they landed. You know, New York was always getting this problem, or the East Coast cities. And we can still identify areas like Minneapolis where there are particular ethnic minorities which are identified with that area. They seem to gravitate there, right? And there were similar reactions. My father-in-law was Swedish. He went to the Swedish part of Chicago, and he said there were the similar things then, that people in Chicago were saying, well, we're going to all end up speaking Swedish, you know? It dissipates after a while. Canada is a different story. But it's a different story altogether.
Okay, but you're trying to tell me the Spanish are going to be...
You see, that the French part of Canada is viewed by the people there as always having been French.
Well, we have French-speaking people in Louisiana, but they speak English, and there's no problem.
And in fact, they always have, you see. But there are still, in Quebec, there are monolingual people who don't speak English.
Well, Louisiana used to belong to France.
Yes, that's true.
And they're still French.
The difference is they have mixed, and the mixture of the people in Quebec with Anglo-speaking Canada has been minimal in that sense.
Well, they came from Canada. They were driven out of Canada to the Cajuns came from Canada.
That's right. That's right. And the very fact that they left was at that time, and practically meant they had to mix. And the basis for the intense belief about Quebec is that this has always been French territory and will remain so. And that's why they're again about to have a vote on whether they should be part of Canada or not. And I predict they will vote their pocketbooks and look at the price tag of leaving and decide to stay and quibble for a few more years about language issues.
What do you anticipate about this influx of Spanish that we're
having? I think it will, in places where it's particularly heavy, it will probably result in some bilingualism. That is, that some of the urban centers in particular, where people will find it useful to speak Spanish who originally spoke English. Yes. That the schools will have to adapt in some way, because they're speaking people who don't, they're teaching to people who don't speak English at home. But that's happened on a smaller scale in other places at other times.
There are hundreds of thousands of people.
That's right.
This is not a small thing. Like
no,
Swedes
I'm saying that was a small scale one. This the thing that is causing so much attention is that the scale of this,
yeah.
Right?
It's a hemorrhage.
That's true, but there. Remember that it may look like hundreds of thousands, but there's still 250 million other Americans who are basically English speakers.
Texas and New Mexico and Arizona.
And of course, Florida would have the same.
Don't you feel, though, that eventually, like with the passing of NAFTA and time, if their standard of living can be raised, some of that will slow down? I mean, it's going to take years, but...
Yes, it will slow down. Initially, too, isn't there some flow of money back from the States into Mexico to relatives and so forth? That phenomenon happens all the time, too.
They do contribute a lot to the economy, however, with their shopping.
Mm-hmm.
And Andy, you're forgetting that a lot of those Mexicans feel in their gut feeling that they're just returning to the country, the land that was there. It's we Americans who took that land, and that is the way they interpret it.
North America didn't belong to Spain to start with, it belonged to the Indians.
Yeah, I know, but the Mexicans ruled that country down there until we took it from them, you know, so they feel they're just, that's our country anyway.
See what happens when language issues get mixed up with politics?
I just I'm having trouble with perpetuating, say, Spanish in the United States.
Well,
I mean, it seems to me we should be trying to assimilate them.
But that doesn't mean they have to give up Spanish.
Well,
I mean,
I think it's fine.
Right. But they don't have to.
It's going to be time for children to learn English.
Why should I pay my tax dollar to perpetuate a problem? The problem is two languages and two cultures.
Because we are...
Someone wants to speak over here. Let's...
Okay.
This is just one example. It's changed. But one of my daughters is a farmer in Eastern Oregon, and they have used Mexican transient labor, and then they have had a man who comes, has been with them for 14 years now. He comes during the growing and planting season and then goes home to Mexico. And they become very annoyed with him because he hasn't become fluent in English. But look at this. I said, Mark, how much opportunity does he really have? He works long hours. You have learned a common language so that you can give him instructions. He goes out in the field and works in the field all day by himself for long hours, goes home to no family, but lives with a couple of other Mexicans. They're tired, they're gonna go home and talk Mexican to each other. And that's his exposure to English. And he is now a legal alien, but Margaret said that without assistance, and the red tape that she ran into to help him become a legal alien, she said he could never have done it. Without assistance. And so there are many people who may be making the effort to assimilate, and there are many, many barriers in their way.
Well, and the truth is, that generation, that person may never assimilate.
Well, that's true.
The next generation will be a different story, and the third generation will probably be indistinguishable from...
His goal is to bring a family here, his family here, so that they can become educated and learn English and get out of the migrant worker situation that his family has been in for years.
And many times you will find with immigrants, whether they're Spanish speaking or something else, you'll find adults going around to doctors or to government offices and so forth, with a child along who does the translation.
Sponsored some Russian people, and there's becoming Little Russia in that group. And when you go there, you know you talk to the children, and they interpret for you.
We have a family friend who's 45. She still goes to the doctor with her mother. She's Maltese. She's from Malta. She has been in Canada for 30-some years, and still doesn't speak enough English to have a conversation with her doctor. So, and that, you know, that generation, that the ones who made the original immigrant step, often do not assimilate.
In Seattle and Vancouver, where there's so many Oriental people coming in, are they needing Oriental languages in the public schools the way the Spanish are wanting Spanish?
Well, there are different models. Many of the ethnic Chinese in Vancouver attend what they call Chinese school on Saturday, where they learn how to write Chinese characters. I mean, the children are usually perfectly fluent in the spoken language, but they learn the Chinese writing, which is not paid any attention to in the schools.
But they're not demanding that Oriental languages be taught
well,
in the schools.
Well, not entirely. The Vancouver Chinese community is a community of Cantonese speakers. One thing they want is to have classes in Mandarin, which is the business language of China. So we do have in the public schools Mandarin courses. And it's, in the university, it's one of the most popular languages. I mean, people just come in droves to take Mandarin. And not just people who are ethnically Chinese, but if you want to have a good future in commerce in the Pacific Rim, Mandarin is a good language to know. So it's not just...
Well, it isn't invading just the way the Spanish is in the South.
Yeah.
Well, there is a difference. We have many Vietnamese in Houston.
Yeah.
In fact, some of the streets now have Vietnamese signs for a street marker. But they've come in, and if you notice when the high school classes are graduating, and you look at the pictures of the kids and the names, most of the valedictorians, the honor students have Vietnamese names. And there's no, they seem, they come with a work ethic. And they suck the, he talked about a guy who, there was a contract, there was a need for work, and he got to want to work, and that's been traditionally what it is. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people that come in here, and they just say, here I am, and you take care of me. Those are the kind of people that we have problems with, not those who come, where there are jobs, and they're willing to work.
And there are young kids that come in, and they're at the top of their class, but they haven't graduated. And they haven't demanded any classes in their language.
Everyone comes with their own cultural baggage.
Right.
Whether it's a work ethic or the Swedes and their Lutheranism, and they bring with them what comes with their particular cultural identity. And for some people, the language is extremely important. I mentioned, I think, Estonians, Lithuanians, Latvians. That's very high on their list. And they work very hard, and they will go to great lengths, and they will also go to great expense to keep, for example, to keep language going in the church and having special Saturday schools or something. I know that, for example, the Estonian Lutheran churches around North America have a very short list of Estonian pastors. But if one of them goes on vacation, they call on one of the other ones to fly in from wherever to preach, because they want that sermon in Estonian, by gum.
The difference is they're doing it themselves.
Yes. Yeah. And different ethnic groups have placed different values on that sort of thing. Yeah.
I think some of the schools are requiring bilingual teachers, particularly Harvard, are anyway.
Yes.
But it's not to teach the kids Spanish, it's just that they can understand and get to teach them English better, and it's kind of almost...
Yes, it is essential.
Yeah. Education. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I can see that if the Indians feel that we deprive them of their cultural heritage, and that the government then now owes them some effort to restore it,
mm-hmm.
that if the Native Americans feel that way, then the Spanish can ride that boat too. And because if we're doing this for the Indians, and for Indian languages, then you certainly don't do it for the Spanish.
Well, with the natives, it's even more explicit than that. I mean, they have dollar figures in mind. The British Columbia government just this past year began negotiating all the land claims that have accumulated over the last 100 years, and those are those are more concrete claims than I think any of the Spanish groups could.
It sets a precedent.
The governments are now willing to recognize these things. I don't think, though, if the Hispanic minority in New Mexico said, well, this was really our land, First of all, they'd get arguments from all the native groups in New Mexico.
That argument
would
float.
Yeah.
Isn't the same, economic status
Mm-hmm.
is important, but isn't the same economic situations are driving this? People aren't flooding over here if they had a good life at home.
Yeah. Economics and politics are always behind these things, and it's almost as if sometimes the language issues are sort of secondary, that this is what comes in with this particular political decision. The business of what's going on with the regulation of immigration from Mexico has consequences, and that's the song you hear the governor singing, right? that immigration and naturalization isn't policing the border, therefore I'm getting all of these people I have to take care of. That's a big issue in California.
Well, and it's a legitimate issue, but especially for California, where the illegal immigration perhaps is higher than anywhere else, but immigration in general is a problem that we don't have to
yes.
look at, but it's there.
Yes, we went straight through without a break today. So I'm going to wind up here a few minutes early. I don't want to knock you out flat before the next session. So in the last few minutes, though, let's wind up and see if there's anything. I know some of you expressed things you might wanted to discuss at the beginning. Did we miss anything? Is there?
You know, Tom, there's just something I always had as a theory. You know, when we were talked about children that were learning two languages.
Yes.
You know, like English and German. I think your children are that way. But
yeah.
What is your theory on the thinking process? Do they think in English, think in German, or are they thinking in their brain computer language?
Well, now you've hit on another area that there's a lot of controversy. There are some points of view that say there is a language of thought. That is, it's not any particular language, and it is like a little computer that ticks away and does logic and things like that. And then our individual languages like English or German or something is a translator that reads what comes out of this language of thought machine and translates it into something you can pronounce. There are other points of view that say, well, we actually do think in different languages and we switch back and forth depending on the context. And I, you know, there's a lot of tantalizing things to think this might be a plausible thing, because if you know two languages and you find yourself in a situation where commonly you do some things in one language and some in another, and then suddenly you're in one context where normally you use the other language and you can't think of the language you're operating in, what the words are for certain things, you know. So I don't think there's any conclusive idea of what's going on there. One thing is sure, that people who are really fluent in a second language don't translate, you know. It just comes out in that language. If they don't do their actual thinking in it, then at least at some very low level, that, you know, the things get organized in that language. Because you don't have to say, now, oh, I have to put the verb at the end, and then what's the preposition there? And, you know, you don't go through that process, which you do early on when you're learning a language, you know, when you're piecing a sentence together, and oh, I finally got it right, you know. Yeah.
Isn't there, another class we've got, of course, is on spirituality, and isn't there something rather spiritual about your first language, especially if that's what you've been taught spiritual things about? Like,
yes.
My mother was taught by her Norwegian grandmother.
Yes.
Most of what she knows about her faith, her prayers as a child and all. And she told me more than once that when she feels closest to God is when she's praying in Norwegian. Even though she was always raised
like my colleague who insists God speaks Greek.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, yeah. That's That's very true. That's yeah. very true.
When you say thee and thou, except in English, except in religious connotation.
Right. Well, I mean, we experience that within English, right? There are some people for whom only the King James Version of the Lord's Prayer will do, because that's the way they learned it.
And the
23rd Psalm. And the Christmas story in Luke, and you can name things. You have something there.
Yeah, there's a ritual there are some stories that are only right in the King James.
That's right. I agree. Well.
the opposite thing is happening. I think it's in this accent of Olden Village right here.
Right.
The woman is writing that she's annoyed by the older use of the Lord's Prayer because she likes.
That's right.
Our mother who art in heaven.
No, well, that was part of it, but it was all over
in cheese.
But you see, we all have very personal associations here, like the grandmother who taught us about, or taught her about, you know, praying in Norwegian. I know the Christmas story in the King James Version has to do with the fact that that's what my father always read at Christmas dinner. You know? And that's a personal association.
That was the one that was always.
That was important to me, right?
Your soul connected there.
Yes.
And he never said she.
No, he didn't. No, he read it right out of the King James just the way it was. That's right. So those kinds of associations are extremely important. They're very personal. There is no use trying to change those. I'm not going to change. And as intellectual as I want to be and say, well, yeah, it would be right, or I should really do that, you know, I am not going to do it. I might as well give up, you know. Yes.
When you were talking about mentioning, you know, no skin off my nose if somebody else's language is, you know, disappeared.
Uh-huh.
The thought that came to me is that's well and good for perhaps for us to say that, but if we put ourselves in that person's position and all of a sudden someone said, you must give up your English language and learn something else,
yes,
it would be some skin off our nose, wouldn't it?
Yeah. The other thing is just in general, you know, things seem a lot better when there's a lot of diversity. I mean, it's more fun when you go out to eat if you've got a choice of, well, shall we eat Thai or shall we eat Mexican, you know. You have all these. No, food. And the same, I think, is true of cultures. You know, suppose North American culture were the only one that was there. And there are people who are afraid of this, that are afraid that might come to pass, that after we get those all the satellite dishes cranked up, that might be all there is. You know? And that frightens some people culturally. Well, we've gone on long enough, and I think we better just go off to coffee break now. And I'm sure you still have plenty of things to talk about.